Welcome to Amnesty International's comedy podcast series. This year, Amnesty's had exclusive backstage access at two of the biggest events on the comedy calendar, the 2014 Edinburgh Festival Fringe and the Balham Comedy Festival in London. We'll be bringing you a series of interviews with some of the greatest stand-up comedians working today, and along with finding out about the business of laughter, we'll be chatting about life, politics, and human rights. This time, we're talking to one of the pioneers of the podcast, Richard Herring. We'll be discussing his most memorable podcast moments with the likes of Stephen Fry and Rufus Hound, and we chat mechanical dogs and demonic monks. So, Richard Herring, thank you for joining Amnesty International backstage at the Balham Comedy Festival.
Good, it's fine. Thanks for having me, it's nice.
How are you doing?
Yeah, it's good. We're in a slightly smelly office backstage.
Quite dark as well, I'm sorry.
It's a bit dark and mysterious. It's scary, yeah, but I'm sure it's all
so
fine.
So how did it go tonight?
It was nice, yeah. I'm sort of, you know, it's a new show, so I've only done it 15 or 20 times or something like that, so I'm just kind of working up on stage, really. So it was, this was probably the first time I got through pretty much the whole thing without having to read anything, so that's good. Well, there's a couple of bits I didn't do. So, yeah, so it's you know, I've got like 2 weeks at this stage to Edinburgh, so that's the important two weeks where you knock it all together. But yeah, I was very, they, you know, it's quite, because it's quite a, there's a lot of stories in the show, so it felt like it took the audience a little while to go, oh, what's going on, and then they sort of got into it and enjoyed it, I think.
Well, yeah. I thought it was great.
Good.
It's called Lord of the Dance Seti.
Yes.
Can you explain a bit about the name and what we're going to see in it?
Yes, well, I mean, there isn't really a theme. I've done theme shows for the last 5 or 6 years, or maybe more than that. So I've done death and religion and the male reproductive organ. I did a whole show about the penis and love and various things. So I kind of wanted to do a show that wasn't really necessarily about anything, although little themes do start to develop because what you're interested in. So it's just stuff. And the title comes from when I was a kid, when you learnt hymns and songs and poems by someone reading them to you, I generally believe the lyrics to Lord of the Dance or Lord of the Dance Seti. I'm the Lord of the Dance Seti. So, which I think a lot of people did. So it's a nice bit of sort of observational comedy without being too observational, that a lot of people go, oh yeah, I did that as well. So I think, and it was actually an old routine I used to do. I did once on the TV show with Stuart, and I just thought it's a really good title for a show, you know, it's a joke.
On This Morning with Richard.
Yeah, we did it. Yeah. So it's just a nice title, but also it's sort of is descriptive of, you know, me. And then I think with that through the show, and when it's finished, I'm going to have a bit more sort of coming back to the settee. I've got a settee on stage and do more stuff about dance as well. Those are sort of the themes that are going to develop. But it's also, and there's another routine I didn't do tonight, which is sort of about looking backwards and forwards at where your career's going. So it's kind of, I think it's kind of apt to use an old joke that most people won't remember, but fans will remember. So hopefully the fans will go, oh, that's funny to see that again. Most of them will. Some of them will go, oh, you're reusing material. Yeah, I've only done 11 different shows in 11 years. Don't worry. But I think it's just a title, really.
I meant to ask what the cool kids are calling it.
Yeah, well, lot de sir.
And you're the self-described king of Edinburgh.
Well, no, loads of people. I don't know where it started. I don't know who started it. But loads is in the list. Six Music. Loads of people build me as that now, which, you know, I don't approve of that kind of thing at all.
And this is your 11th consecutive show?
Yeah. I mean, I've done probably, I'm approaching 40 shows over the 27 years or something that I've been going up. I haven't been up every year. I missed about 5 years. So I think this is my 23rd Fringe this year. But yeah, I've been involved with writing or performing in, I mean, near performing in probably 37 shows and then written a couple of others.
So are you looking forward to it? Is it same old, same old?
Well, I am looking forward to it. I'm doing a play this year as well, which makes it a bit different, a bit exciting. I haven't done a play for 15 years, so I've written a play. It's just, to be honest, the last few years, I've always thought, well, I'm definitely going to either make a little bit of money or not lose anything. And this year I could lose £50,000 on the play. You know, that adds a sort of new frisson to the month. So hopefully things will go all right and people will come and see stuff. But
stressful.
Well, it makes it a little bit stressful. It's been really hard writing a play. So, it's been kind of fun doing this at night. I haven't had any time to sit down and work on this. I've just been doing it on stage. I've been working very, very hard on the play. So hopefully it will pay off. But no, that's what's exciting about it. You do something, you can do something amazing and nobody discovers it. You know, I wrote 4 plays in the 90s, which I was very pleased with, and they all got kind of reasonable reviews, but nothing happened with anything. So, you know, it's we've got like a really good cast. Nicola McAuliffe's in it, who's a really top actor, and so you know, hopefully it will be good. But yeah, so I'm looking forward to it, but it's always a bit of an emotional roller coaster, and you are terrified about it. I'm still not at the stage where I can sell out, you know, definitely sell out without good reviews and stuff.
And the show's called I Killed Rasputin.
Yes, it is.
The Russian monk.
Well, it's more about the guy who killed him. So it's about Felix Yusupov, who killed him, and he was interviewed. He lived till the late 1960s, which is sort of freaky. And he was interviewed in the late 1960s. So it's sort of set in this interview when they interviewed Felix Yusupov. But Rasputin is a sort of ghostly figure within it. And it's a, you know, sort of about, it's a comedy play, but it's got kind of themes about being judged by one act and repressed sexuality and all sorts of that, and you know, super rich and super poor people. I mean, there's a lot to learn from the Russian Revolution, I think, in the Western world now, from the super rich, many of whom are Russian, and the super poor, and how eventually the super poor go, oh, hold on, I'm not sticking for this anymore. So yeah, but it's about the kind of mystery of what actually happened, which everyone seems to accept that Rasputin was kept on coming back to life again.
Yeah,
which, when you sort of think about it, did not happen.
He was poisoned, shot, chucked in ice.
Beaten, you know, shot a few times, and then supposedly drowned. But he did that. It's not really a true story. So
we have to find out the truth by going.
Well, it's just. I find it interesting that such a recent historical character has been mythologized, and so it's actually, given he lived in, you know, the photos of him and film of him, and he, you know, not quite living memory now, but certainly 50 years ago, living memory. It's very hard to get a handle on what Rasputin was really like, and he's become this sort of demonic, evil, hypnotic monk. And I think he was probably generally quite a good guy.
I've heard you've gone a bit warhorse with it. You've got a mechanical dog.
I do have a dog. Yeah, we do have a dog, which is a sort of puppeteered thing. We have to work out we're going to get a puppeteer or the actors are going to all be able to do it. It's really good. I didn't think it would be that good, but yeah, we saw, because I had like these two interviews that I could use, and they both mentioned the dog, and you know, so I started writing with the dog in, and I thought, well, we're not be able to do that. We'll just have to imagine the dog. But they've come up with a way of, you know, I didn't think we were going to have a real dog. It would be probably more problematic. So we've got this very lifelike, well, you know, slightly cartoony, but rather sweet little dog that moves, and all its ears move, and it blinks, and it's going to slobber.
That's pretty. Is it radio controlled? Or?
No, it's like, so the actors are going to have to operate it as, you know, with sticks and, you know, and little switches and stuff.
I'm really pleased you've actually got a dog in it, because in The Woman in Black, they ask you to imagine the dog.
Do they, right?
And I'm like, I paid £40.
Well, I'm glad, you know, I'm glad. It's not like a major character in it, but it comes back a little bit. So, yeah, it'd be interesting to see.
I was wondering why you focused on Rasputin quite a lot. I think you had a show, Ra Ra Rasputin, in the 90s.
Yeah.
About the Bonium song.
Yeah. Well, that was more comedic. They're both for comedies, but which I've written as a sitcom as well, which is the idea that Rasputin wrote all of Boney M's music and was the world's first pop star, which he sort of was. He was sort of was a rock star, in that he was taken from poverty and then projected into fame and got money and sort of women showered on him, which is the point of making I Killed Rasputin. But so in Ra Ra Rasputin, it's more of a knockabout.
Yeah.
And to begin with, it was a sort of satire of the royal family at the time, like Charles and Diana. When I rewrote it, it was sort of more of a satire of the political situation now. But yeah, but it's sort of quite broad. It was a bit broader and a bit more silly.
And it's your specialist subject on Mastermind.
It was, yeah. So I've just always been fascinated by Rasputin. So, and I think it's funny, but it's also, you know, it's his murders, and it's a comedy, really, with his murder, but then obviously it's a brutal, horrible thing. And so it's treated as this melodramatic kind of Hammer horror thing. And then hopefully again in the play that will come across, and that the story is kind of, oh, how romantic and weird and scary. But the reality is quite brutal and unpleasant. The man was, even if they're telling the truth, was shot and sort of beaten to death in a cellar. So that's not very nice, is it? Not a very nice way to go. It's not very funny, really, is it, when you think about it?
Well, I can't wait to see it at Edinburgh. But cool. Talking of Edinburgh, I've read that you that one of your first Edinburgh shows was Sabotage by the actor Keith Allen.
Yeah, it was. Yeah,
what's that all about?
The Oxford Review, which was my second year. We're unfortunate that we went to Edinburgh as students just at the time when, just after the time where stand-up had come into the ascendancy and student comedy was sort of being pummeled. But there was a long history of Oxford and Cambridge comedy people creating big stars, but that sort of stopped happening. So we didn't get any of that bonus, but all the stand-up people were sort of furious with this perceived and, you know, I think slightly actual privilege that was given to these institutions, but partly because no one else was going up and doing comedy, to be honest. So they all kind of basically came and heckled us at various gigs, and Keith Allen came to the first night and moved a crash mat and then punched the theatre manager and left, and then gave us a terrible review after seeing one sketch that he sabotaged. And then we went on TV to give our right to reply, and then he just kind of bullied us some more and nearly made me cry on television. So I was a little 19-year-old boy. It was quite a humiliating, or 20-year-old boy. It was like a quite humiliating and upsetting experience that nearly put me off comedy. I was looking out into the audience, the Gilded Balloon, seeing all the comedians I admired just laughing at me and shouting, and laughing at me in a bad way and heckling and not listening to anything we had to say. So it was quite a traumatic experience. But yeah, Keith Allen was the pinpoint of that. So that's why I go on about him a little.
Just sounds mean.
It was a little bit mean. It was a little bit, you know, when you take it out of context and just look at what it is, it's a grown man bullying some 19-year-old comprehensive school kids, in fact, as it turned out, because we'd all been to comprehensive school and got into Oxford because of our good A-level results. So, you know, we weren't really the people that they were angry with. But, you know, it's all character building. I think the failures, actually, and the unpleasant experiences make you better as a personal comedian. He's doing all right. And his daughter's doing all right. And his son's doing all right. He's in Game of Thrones. It's amazing.
But talking of doing all right, I mean, you are pioneering new media yourself. You have released numerous podcasts, prolific tweeter and blogger. You've got a Vimeo-only TV show.
Yes.
You've got 4 shows on Netflix.
Yeah, I do, yeah. That's nice.
And do you think the traditional route of a comedian relying on television to make it, so to speak, is kind of over?
I don't think it's over, but I think it's dying, I think. So, and I think it doesn't, you know, even when you are on TV, me and Stu were on TV, and it never didn't really help us at the time, I don't think, to get an audience. Even if you're on TV, you have to break through somehow. But I think now there's so much TV that actually having your own internet channel is about the same as being on Dave or something, really, in terms of, you know, I'll get like 150,000 listeners to Rich Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast or something, which probably would be a good night on Dave if someone listened to it, if 150,000 people watched a Dave programme. Admittedly, you know, mine's spread over a long period of time. So, I mean, I think the nice thing is you can do it on your own. It's cheap enough it's getting cheap enough, and the technology's there, which you wouldn't have been 20 years ago, to get stuff out there. So if you're interested in being autonomous and doing what you want to do, and aren't that interested in becoming famous or being paid, then you can do it, you know. And it pays off down the line, because people then hopefully come and see you at live, see you live, or, you know, or buy a DVD or whatever. So yeah, so it seems to have rescued my career at a point where it might have not been feasible to carry on, or certainly to do. You know, I was touring even after Lee and Herring. I was touring, and 20 or 30 people would come and see me most places, which is all right, but it's not really enough to make a living from. But now, you know, 250, 300 people, sometimes 500 people, sometimes 600 people will come and see me in the town, which is a great work with a good living. So if you can do that, so, you know, as long as you balance that up, and I'm happy to do stuff for free. Like Meaning of Life is a thing that I've done for free. That's a six months of doing a show a month, and, you know, an hour and a half long show a month, which 45 minutes of it is written. So
all funded by you.
Yeah. So, you know, but then people are contributing afterwards, and people are buying the right to watch longer versions of it, and we'll probably put it on DVD. So, you know, I think that will make its money back. This year I'm just sort of thinking, you know, I don't have a family yet, and, you know, I'm doing all right with my work, so why not channel some of that money back in to try and see if I can, what I can do. So Meaning of Life's more of an important bridge, going, let's see if we can do a TV show on our own. And we've learned a lot from it, and I'm pleased with it. It kind of, you know, there's things that don't work, and there's things that I'd like to change about it, but it's, you know, for no pounds, it's pretty good.
No, I enjoy it. And it's pioneering.
Yes, so that's what's exciting about it. So it feels like a bridge to something else, but yeah, hopefully, you know, check it out. It's on Vimeo, it's on YouTube, and, you know, go for a scrub and buy it if you want to buy it.
And talking of your Leicester Square podcast, you're pretty famous for asking the kind of questions that other interviews dare not ask. What's the most surprising answer you've got, and who was it from?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, it's more surprising. I suppose, you know, the most surprising one is probably the Stephen Fry thing, which is the thing I will hark on about a lot. But in the Stephen Fry one, there was a question asked by the director's son, which was What's It Like Being Stephen Fry, which we didn't weren't expecting like a comedy answer to, or a brief answer to, or just like, oh fuck off, that's a stupid question. But Stephen Fry kind of gave a very honest answer and sort of revealed that he'd attempted suicide in the year before that he'd never told anyone about. So that was a surprise. And Rufus Hound was very open about why he left Celebrity Juice. So it's kind of interesting when people get serious because it's sort of surprising. Mm. But it does happen. It has this nice flow because it goes on. It's such a long conversation. It tends to be very funny for the first 15, 20 minutes and everyone's trying to be funny, and then it relaxes and people can't keep up that level of laughter anyway. So then it comes a bit more stories, and then about the hour mark it often gets a little bit thoughtful and serious. There's all sorts. I mean, I'm not very good at. I don't really remember what's happened after, and I don't really listen back to them. So often, often people come up, and this is true of a lot of my comedy. People come up and quote something at me, and I don't know it's my own thing that they're quoting. And there's so much stuff now. You know, there's stuff from the 1990s with me and Stu, you know, on radio that people sometimes quote. But there's hours and hours of podcasts. So I can't.
It's like 45.
Yeah,
45, I think.
Well, there's 45 of those, and there's 100 and something, you know, nearly 200 Collins and Aaron podcasts, and you know, hundreds of warming ups, and 75 Edinburgh Fringe podcasts. So there's a lot of stuff out there. You have to be pretty determined and committed to you know. I'm almost podcasting 24 hours a day, so you'll sort of have to be with me in order to have consumed it all, I think. But
I love the fact you chuck in the question, have you ever seen a ghost?
Yes. Well, you know, because when someone has, it'll be an amazing, have you ever seen a Bigfoot? You know, no one has yet, but when that that pays off and someone goes, oh yeah, I haven't, I've never told this story before about when I saw a Bigfoot. Thanks for reminding me, Rich. That's what I'm hoping will happen. But so far it hasn't happened. But occasionally those questions do lead into something else, because people will, as long as you're not asking people what they always get asked, because people want to be entertaining, they will do their best to try and think of something, and then they're not just trotting out their stories, which sometimes you do. Sometimes they trot out the stories, which is fine. But then they have to go, and then they think of something, and then they're creating actual comedy and telling a story they've never told before, rather than falling back on an anecdote, you know, which is, so that's where it gets interesting, I think. So you ask a stupid question, and the way they deal with a stupid question, you know, I think David Mitchell sort of treated me like I was a very intelligent 6-year-old boy, you know, when he was answering all my questions, which is probably about the right thing to do. So it wasn't, he didn't get angry that some of it was cheeky and rude, but he just very patiently answered the questions in the spirit they were asked. You know, sometimes people don't quite know how to respond, and get, you know, a couple of people got slightly, and not only Stephen Merchant got slightly upset with the way things went, but only very mildly, just because he didn't understand what's happening, I think, rather than any genuine anger. But yeah, so it's, you know, those are fun, you know, and that they're kind of easy enough to do, and we're doing another 22 of those, I think, in the autumn, because we're doing another 11 weeks of it in the autumn. So there'll be, you know, again, there'll be like 50 of those this year or something, almost 40 or 50 of those this year. So, you know, I'm hoping that people who listen to it will think, oh, we'll give him £1 this year. We'll go to his website and donate £1 and get a badge or not get a badge. To be honest, if everyone did that once a year who listens to it, then I could start, you know, and I'm only going to use that money to make more stuff. Mm. So I could start making some really exciting stuff. So that's the hope, that that people will start, you know, feeling, oh yeah, we will donate a tiny bit of money for this huge amount of entertainment we get. If they would do it monthly, that's better, you know, so I'm getting people the opportunity to pay £1 a month or more a month.
That's a bargain.
Well, it's, you know, it is when you think about it, but obviously it's free. I also don't want to exclude anyone who can't afford to pay £1 a month, so I still put it out for nearly everything out for nothing. So there's bonus stuff for people who pay, but you know, I also think the value of it is people will like, if people like you, they'll listen to it, and if they listen to it, they might buy something or come and see you eventually. So you know, if they do that once every now and again, that's all that will keep me going.
So talking of taking risks in comedy, Amnesty supports the right to freedom of expression, but do you think
you're correct to do that?
Thank you. Do you think there are some comedians who rely on the shock and offence style of comedy too much?
Some do, but it's a valid form of freedom of expression, and it's a valid form of comedy, and I think it can, when it's done well, it's amazing. So Jerry Sadovitz is amazing and shocking and upsetting, and I find him upsetting, and he says horrible things, but he says it about everyone. And so it's more of a thing, you know, if it was, you wouldn't go to Macbeth or King Lear and go, oh, loads of people got murdered, and that's really bad. you know, that's wrong. Why are they showing that on stage? So, you know, it's. I think a lot of it's because people think comedy isn't an art form, or think comedy should just be jokes, or they think if you're joking about something, you're not taking it seriously. And none of those things are true. So you can joke. You can joke about something very serious, and find the humour in it. You can even be offensive about something in order to make people think about it. So I don't really have a problem with people doing that. Sometimes I have a problem if it's just a terrible joke, or it's a really hackneyed joke, or it's just adding to the problem. If it's just, you know, a rape joke that's about I'm gonna rape you, you know. A, it's been done a lot, and B, I mean, both as a joke and in reality, but B, it's you know, it's just horrible. So it depends whether you want to see comedy as being bullying, which it can be, or whether you want to see comedy protect, you know, fighting against bullying, if you're punching up or down, you know. But you know, someone like Frankie Boyle, who I think does some amazing political stuff, I sometimes a bit disappointed in him, and just I think that joke's not that good, you know, that's not worthy of the good stuff you do,
yeah,
and is just offensive for the sake of being offensive. But also there is a release valve, you know, that if you get people in a room and talk about disability or whatever it is, then you're dredging up people's fears, and that's helping them deal with it. And if you're talking about those subjects, then that, even if the conversation is you shouldn't be doing that, you are getting something going. So you know, I think the when you see a 20-year-old brand new comedian who's seen someone like Frankie Boyle probably, and just go, oh, I understand what comedy is, it's just being rude and swearing and saying the most offensive thing you can, then you see what it done badly, and you see that, you know, and it isn't funny, and no one's enjoying it, and it's just upsetting people. But, you know, hopefully, I do stuff that's close to the bone, and I do stuff that upsets people sometimes, but you have to kind of balance it up. I don't want to upset anyone, but you have to balance it up against someone will be upset by every single joke you do.
Yeah.
You'll be amazed what people will get upset about. Yeah. And so, you know, and if, as long as you have good reason for doing it, I think it is worth doing. So, you know, that I did that routine tonight about the railways and the Holocaust magazine, which is making a serious point about how comedy is not as bad as taking, you know, doing comedy about death is not as bad as being serious about death in a kind of ghoulish way. And you'll get away with that if you're not joking, and that seems wrong to me. So, you know, by pulling apart this magazine and every single aspect of this magazine is funny, and you're laughing, you're not laughing at the Holocaust.
Yeah, no.
But you are laughing around the Holocaust. So, you know, some people have got upset about that, but I'm not going to stop doing that routine because I know why I'm doing it. So one in a 10,000 people comes up to me and go, you think that's funny, do you? You think the Holocaust is funny? And I go, no, I don't think the Holocaust is funny. I think it's not funny. That's why I think we should be having, I don't think we should be having this magazine, you know, as a serious magazine. So, you know, so you've got to justify it yourself, and I'll listen, you know, and if people sometimes just go, it's not worth it. It's not worth, that joke isn't worth upsetting five people over, or that, you know, so people often get very upset about a word, going, oh, I'm not allowed to say this word now, and I'm going to say it more because I'm not allowed to say it. And then you go, well, actually, you know, maybe don't say the word. Maybe if it's upsetting five people really badly.
Talking of the Ricky Gervais.
Well, yeah, well, that's an example. You know, maybe just, I mean, I would never tell anyone I'd never say anything's off bounds. I'd just say, is it worth doing a joke using the word mong, for example, that isn't even a good joke, knowing it's going to upset some disabled people? Is that worth doing? Even if you, in your heart, are thinking, I'm not doing it for that reason, I think you've got to take a step back. And I've done that. I've used disabled language in the past, and then you get to a point where you go, oh yeah, maybe, well, actually I can do this joke without using the word retarded or, you know, whatever. So why not do that? Why risk it unless you're doing it for a really good reason? But then I've used racist language in routines about racist language to make the point that the words themselves aren't the thing. That the problem is, it's not the words, it's the way you use them.
The sort of self-censoring would be,
well, you know, but yeah, but I, you know, I'm saying that you just have to take, it's not like going, you can't ever say that word. I've just said the word mong in a sentence to say I wouldn't use it in a joke, but I've used the word mong. It's not like saying it's a word that you can't use, it's a word that exists, and it's a word, you know, I don't know, like pussyfooting around and going, oh, the M-word or whatever, or any of those words. Why not say it? Because if you allude to it, people know what you mean anyway. So I would just say, don't use it unless there's a really good reason for using it. You know, so that's it. So I think it's up to you and your conscience and what you want to do with your comedy. And if you want to laugh at the poor and the weak and people in prison and Holocaust victims. You can, you know, you can do that if you want. But the problem is when people interpret. So, you know, people just hear a word in a routine and then they decide you're laughing at the thing.
Hmm.
And so you can't just do blanket rules because that isn't. Yeah. So then I can't do that Railways in the Holocaust routine that's made a room full of people really laugh. Hmm. Who have got it, because one person's going, no, you can't joke about the Holocaust.
Taken out of context, yeah.
Yeah, same.
So, talking of human rights, the Conservatives recently said that they might scrap the Human Rights Act after the next election. What do human rights mean to you?
Well, you know, I mean, that's sort of so unbelievable that a government could say that and then still be electable. You know, the human rights are the rights to say what you want, believe what you want, and do what you want without harming other people, I suppose. So it's, you know, and we've got the right to expect to live in a world where we're protected by people, by our governments, really, and the people who are, you know, around us. So if you haven't done anything wrong, and, you know, you should be hoping the Conservative government would be looking after your human rights. So yeah, I mean, I think it's very important to have free speech. It's very, you know, to the extent that whatever people believe, I think they should be allowed to say it. They don't have to agree with me. You know, I'm very happy for the British National Party to exist. I think those people should be allowed to speak much more, because the more they speak, I think the more it all will fall apart. And so that for me is that's the same with comedy. When people, you can't joke about this, you can't talk about this, you kind of go, well, anything we can't talk about, that's a problem, you know, because that's like you're saying, we've got to shut this off. If there's a right and wrong with it, we should be able to talk about it.
Yeah.
But, you know, you should be able to talk about your race. If you're a racist, you should be able to talk about your views and have a conversation about them, because unless they're right and you're shutting them down, then if they're wrong, which we're presuming they are, then they're going to, you know, the conversation and a discussion is going to show that. So I find it weird when anyone, you know, when anyone's banned, and that's why I suppose a lot of my comedy, whenever there's a brick wall, oh, you can't joke about that, you can't talk about that, this is definitely the way things are. I, you know, I, on both sides of the comedy, liberal stuff and right-wing stuff, I will, that's the thing I will always go up against. If people are saying we can't, that's not up for discussion.
Mm.
Because if what you believe is true, then discuss it till the cows come in. The things that people will stop you discussing are like, you know, if you get into religion and then you go, well, let's talk about where this religion started. No, we can't. You only have to go from this one book. The minute you start saying there are rules to the conversation, and you know, that's a conversation that breaks down. So if you, and people only stop you talking about something if they're fascists, or if they are so strongly believe an idea that they won't allow you, anyone else, to differ from that idea. So I think the human right to be able to believe whatever you want to believe, however stupid and wrong and ludicrous it is, but that human right also means you have to listen, or, you know, other people have to be allowed to then put the counterpoint to that. You can't just go, it's my human right to believe in a massive man in the sky who's looking after me and loves me more than everyone else. You know, you are allowed to do that, but we should be able to talk about it. So yes, I would love to live in a world where a government thought the idea of human rights was a thing that would get them elected, rather than the idea of closing down human rights would get you elected. I mean, that's the problem, is that people sort of go, oh, it's all political correctness, it's political correctness. But, you know, political correctness is basically politeness, and it's basically allowing everyone to be the same. And so by turning into this bugbear, it's that thing I talk about in one of those routines about, you know, claiming you're an oppressed minority from a position of obvious majority superiority. But that's the inevitable, you know, things are very slightly tugging away from your massive field of influence, so now you're going to have to turn it on those tiny little people who've managed to change one thing, so now feminism's wrong, or, you know, all immigrants are terrible or whatever. So you just, you know, it's all about power. But you know, human rights are extremely important,
and your shows, I mean, they do deal with big topics. Christ on a Bike was all about religion, and Hitler Mustache talks about race and politics. Do you feel you got to a point where it wasn't enough just making an audience laugh, but you also like to make them think?
I like to make them think, but it's not really just that. You know, this year I feel a bit like I want to make them laugh, you know, and I'm not that bothered about... I mean, I think there are always sort of thoughtful things will come in. Because I think those... I think a lot of those things, again, just come from the closed system of thought, that it's just fun to dig away at those philosophies, like fascism and, you know, up to an extent, some religious philosophies that won't allow counterpoint to them. So that makes them appealing to me. With the talking cock, which is about penises, that's partly because we don't talk about that subject seriously. Mm. So, you know, that's, to me, that was what was interesting about it. I think if you're thinking intelligently about stuff, you can't just be flippant and joke about everything, you know. So you're going to get into slightly more serious subjects, but I always want them to be funny, you know. I'll allow myself a little bit of, you know, a couple of minutes here and there where there's not going to be jokes or there's not going to be laughs, but my job is to make people laugh. But I think there's, you know, I think there's a lot of humour in those big subjects, and I think there's enough people who want you to talk a bit more than just about what it's like at the senior supermarket queue, or, you know, which is fine. If you can do great observational comedy, that's great, and I don't have a problem with it. There's a lot of bad observational comedy, but it's very, very hard to do it. But if you want a bit more, if you want to think about stuff. So, you know, yeah, with Hitler Moustache, it was great. People went, you know, people would tweet me and say, oh, we just had a two-hour discussion about democracy after watching your show, after they've been laughing all the way through, you know, so that's nice for me. So, yeah, you want to have a little bit. But I've always been a comedian. I've always wanted to be a comedian. I've always wanted to be funny. I'm not really hankering to go, oh, can't wait to do my hour-long, you know, serious political treatise with no jokes in it. I want to make people laugh is my ultimate goal.
So finally, I read that you, in 1992, you almost thought about giving up stand-up, and save for an excellent gig here at the Ball in Bedford.
I did. This was one of the... I sort of gave up doing stand-up on my own. But I did. This was one of the places I did really well at. So it isn't quite that it saved it, because I did stop. I did like 1989, just started 1991, and maybe into 92. But I wasn't enjoying being on my own doing stuff. I was kind of writing more sketches, and we started writing the radio stuff together, me and Stu, and sort of doing a double act. So I kind of wasn't enjoying stand up, and it probably comes out of all that Oxford Review experience, that I felt a bit like ostracized by the community, even though I don't think anyone knew I was. I remember having a fantastic gig. They used to do a gig down where I just was, and then if it was really popular, there'd be a gig in this room here. I don't know if it's even there now. So there would be two gigs. So you'd do two gigs, which A, meant you got paid twice, which was amazing. Think about the same you get paid now. it's 25 years ago. But then, yeah, I came and closed the show up here, and Bob Mills was on. Bob Mills was closing down there. And yeah, and I got an encore, and, you know, didn't really have anything to do as an encore. It was so early, and, you know, that was within the first sort of 9 or 10 months. So I'd do gigs then, and I'd be torn between doing what I wanted to do, doing what I thought the audience would want, and doing what I thought the promoter would want. And I would just fall between the stools, really. So I'd have a good gig, and then I'd have two mediocre gigs where I wasn't quite doing the right thing. And usually the good gigs, the promoter would happen not to be there that night or whatever, you know. So I was struggling to get on, but yeah, it was nice to come here and do a good gig. So that probably did, and, you know, do an encore and feel like, oh, okay, I could potentially do this. But then I decided not to do it anyway. For, you know, I came back and it was sort of 2004, basically, when I did Hercules Terrace, which was a show where I took on lots of challenges. I sort of went, well, and I'd done three one-man shows, but I didn't count them as stand-up. And then I thought, well, why am I not doing stand-up? Why have I got this, you know, aversion to doing it? So because I'd done all these things, I thought, right, I'll go back and do stand-up. So, that's sort of 10 years, I suppose, now, coming up to 10 years that I've been back doing stand-up. And in a way, I kind of slightly regret that I didn't keep it up, because, you know, I think I'd be, if I'd done those 10 years that I stopped doing it for, I'd be a lot better than I am now, I think. But you know, it's just time, you know. The time's got to be right, and I wasn't enjoying it. So I'm glad I came. You know, it's, again, that and the internet stuff is what saved me. If I hadn't come back to do... Because I just need... I don't need to be on TV. I don't need to be in massive theatres. I wouldn't mind either of those things necessarily. But as long as I'm performing to some people every now and again, that gets that part of my...
Yeah.
That gets out there, and then I'm happy. You know, 10 years ago, I was sitting writing books and scripts, and it's really sad, very lonely and depressing. Just being able to go out and see people and make people laugh, and that's enough performing for me. I've got that. I need to do a bit of performing, but that's enough. So I'm really enjoying doing stand-up now, and it's, you know, I count myself as a stand-up comedian, which I wouldn't have done 20 years ago and 10 years ago. I'm a stand-up comedian who also writes, rather than the writer who does a bit of stand-up comedian, I think, so a bit of stand-up comedy.
So it's always good to come back to the Bedford.
It is. The Bedford's an amazing venue. And, you know, Balham, I've lived in Balham for a long time, when I was, you know, probably between seven, 10 years, just on and off. Then it got a bit wet. You know, when I'm glad I left when I did, it started getting a bit full of estate agents and lawyers and stuff. It was kind of, used to be a nice mixed community of all kinds of different jobs and cultures and ages. And it's got a bit gentrified, but I do like, I still like Balham.
Well... I, for one, am glad you didn't give up comedy.
Good, me too.
And thank you very much, Richard Herring,
thank you
for joining us.
Cool, no problem.
If you're interested in learning more about human rights or joining Amnesty International, then please go to our website, amnesty.org.uk, and make sure you don't miss our next episode. Here's a sneak peek.
The only difference I've seen between a British sense of humour and everybody else's sense of humour is British people is the only one who asks you that question. They're very preoccupied. But British people are very proud of their sense of humor. Like, no one has a sense of humor the way we have a sense of humor. Huh? What kind of sense of humor you got? We have a 1,000-year tradition.